Welcome to the program for Friday, July 27, 2012, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's the Federal News Countdown, the three most important federal news stories of the week, chosen by two people who are experts in the world of the federal government. And this week, my experts doing the choosing are John Palguda of the Partnership for Public Service. Good to see you as always, sir.
Good morning, Francis. Good to be here. Good afternoon,
Afternoon, technically, it is, but indeed. It's a little cloudy outside, so you can understand. I can understand why you would go there. And Jason Miller, the executive editor of Federal News Radio and federalnewsradio.com.
Been a while. I haven't had the joy. I haven't had the joy and the opportunity.
This is good.
And I love having you on the show as always. We joke every once in a while that when we get desperate, it's just you and me. And we should actually schedule that because that is fun to do sometimes. But it's good to have John here. You're a regular on the show, and your colleague Tim McManus is always a great addition
indeed,
to the program.
Indeed, and we both
too.
Have fun when we're here.
Well, thank you. That's part of the point of this. But the other part of the point of this is to understand what people through a broad cross-section of the federal government think are the most important news stories that are happening in the world of the government. And we start this week with...
Number three!
And a bit of an anomaly in the third spot because occasionally we have folks who choose the same second most important story, and the number one story sometimes is very self-evident. It's very rare, in fact, it may have never happened before, that two people have chosen the same third most important federal news story of the week, but you've gone and done it, the two of you. The headline is Sequestration Could Spur Furloughs at Education. It is Ruben Gomez's and Keith Beer-Golick's story on federalnewsradio.com. And the first thing that jumped out at me, gentlemen, when I saw this story this week was how weird is it that we've gone almost 180 degrees from the administration saying we're not planning for sequestration, we're not looking at it, this is bad policy, you members of Congress should fix this, to what I think is the polar opposite of that, which is not only have we thought about it, not only are we starting to figure out a strategy, but it may involve furloughing people and some of the other things that Secretary Duncan talks about here. John, why is this important in your mind this week?
Well, it's important for a couple of reasons. I mean, of course, big picture wise, you know, sequestration, as everybody will acknowledge, could be a real disaster for the operations of government. I think in part it was intended to be because it was, you know, it's going to be so terrible that, of course, we'll come up with something better. But I think we're playing again, chicken politics of, you know, who's going to blink first. But I think what's important this week is that we're starting now to see some real discussion about, you know, if somebody doesn't blink, here's what the train wreck looks like. So we've got Arne Duncan talking about, you know, furloughs, but it's not just about the impact on employees, it's the impact on programs. So he's talking about, you know, we're going to have to slash spending on the work we do around processing student loans and doing oversight and preventing fraud, waste, mismanagement and all that. And yesterday, the president got on his desk the Sequestration Transparency Act of 2012. That and we'll see if he signs it or not, but it did pass the House by a 414-2 vote. And basically that says, okay, Mr. President, in the next 30 days, we want more details like the Secretary of Education is starting to provide, but we want it across the board. What are the details? What's it going to look like if sequestration happens?
Now, something, Jason, that John said, the prevention of fraud, waste, mismanagement, I wonder if this isn't on Congress's mind to some degree, because one thing that we saw the last summer when we went through the whole shutdown deal was very quietly, kind of under the radar screen, members of Congress looked into what did it cost to go through the shutdown process that never happened, how much got wasted doing that compared to the disagreement that we had with the other side. I'm speaking in for Congress, that we had with the other side about money, and it turns out was almost a wash because it costs a lot of money to prepare to shut down and then prepare to reopen.
I would say from my experience of talking to federal employees and covering this stuff, that planning happens. It just doesn't happen publicly, and it happens kind of very quietly. And when Congress calls you, especially the Senate calls you, it's a Democratic-led Senate, so it's a friendlier venue to talk about these issues. I think it just makes sense to put out. Now, remember, Tom Harkin also put out a report that same day to talk about what sequestration would mean in terms of people and workforce issues. And so I'm not sure if I totally agree with you, Francis, that it's a complete 180. I would just say it's another step down the path where, of course, the administration is going to bang the drum as loud as possible, get companies to bang the drum as loud as possible to say, look how bad this is, look how bad this is, look how bad this is. But now as we start getting into August and as we start getting closer to Congress, I heard Congressman Jerry Connolly speak just yesterday. He said there's 14 legislative working days left before the election. So basically, as we get closer to that end of the election, I think it's just the louder you bang, the more attention you bring to yourself. The reason I thought this was a significant story was there's been a lot of focus on the Defense Department and the fact that the defense – what's the impact on the Defense Department and the Defense Industrial Group and the like. And this is the first one that's been a real big focus on the civilian agencies because, you know, the Defense Department – a $50 billion cut to the Defense Department is big, but it's a $400 and $500 billion budget, a $50 billion cut across 100 agencies. That's sometimes to some agencies that's their entire budget. Their portion is their entire budget. So I think that's why this to me was a much more was an important story.
You are right in that just about the entire conversation, John, about sequestration has been on the Defense Department. They've really sucked all the oxygen out of the sequestration room, so to speak. And this is, as Jason said, it's the first thing I've heard about what might happen at other agencies beyond the administration, OMB saying VA, at least the benefits that VA recipients get won't be touched by sequestration, won't be affected. But other than that, I've heard nothing else until this about how this might affect civilian agencies.
That's right, Francis. And the fact of the matter is the impact on the non-defense agencies, as Jason says, could actually be much greater, particularly for a number of agencies out there that are labor intensive. They don't have contracts or major programs or other things to cut or suspend. It's people. And this goes into effect. They have no choice but to lay off large numbers of people, and then that causes all sorts of disruption. Even if you get to bring them back at some point.
A couple of the comments we've gotten around this issue, and I think a couple of comments on this story, was, great, lay off people. You want smaller government? Well, here you go, smaller government with fewer services as well. And that's a great move, Congress. I mean, that's people commenting on the story. This is not us talking about it.
But you know what? That actually gets to something that I've talked about on this show for a long time, which is maybe this is the silver lining in this. Maybe this is the beginning of an adult discussion about what smaller budgets at agencies mean. Okay, Secretary Duncan is saying, if we have this much smaller amount of money, this is how we're going to strategize that. This is how we're going to respond to that and let Congress, who is elected by the people to make these decisions, decide if they like the way that looks or not. And maybe we get to a point where people are telling people in their districts and states are telling members of Congress, you know, we're not so crazy about this idea after all. I don't know if that's the result or not, but at least we'll maybe start to head toward a result of some sort, some decision-making process.
And one would hope, Francis, it goes beyond if we start getting into that more productive part of the dialogue, what does smaller government really look like in terms of reduced services and benefits and so on? The hope would be that transcends to the larger dialogue around, okay, what do we really want government to do, and what are we willing to have government not do?
Well, and that's why I alluded to the fact that maybe the smaller government part of it isn't the end result. Maybe it is, you know, maybe we're willing to pay for these extra things, and maybe the folks that are saying we should reduce the size of government, spend less on it, maybe that's not what the public decides they actually want, because ultimately it's up to them and not to 535 people on the Hill.
I just want to go back to one thing that John said about the labor-intensive. One of the things that Arne Duncan talked about at this hearing was, his comment was, you know, we don't have a lot of flexibility here. I think we'd have to cut across the board. It's a horrendous way to think about budget choices. You're right. I think the fact is that these civilian agencies, the majority of their money goes to two areas. I think three areas, I guess, grants and contracts or people. And, you know, if the grants don't get out, that's going to be painful to the big, broad general public. And if people get cut, then the grants aren't going to get out anyways, because there's no one to push them out
to
review
them,
and do all the things you need to do. So either way, the effect, the civilian agency effect, I think is not being talked about enough, and is could have a much bigger overall impact on the country and then the DOD impact. Now, let me just say one last piece about this is, I don't think sequestration is going to happen. I mean, Jerry Connolly's quote from yesterday was, something to the effect of probably almost confident that that's not going to happen.
Kind of, sort of, maybe, almost.
Exactly. He hedged his bets well for his constituents there in Arlington.
The third most important federal news story of the week, as selected this week by both guests on the Federal News Countdown, John Palguta of the Partnership for Public Service and my colleague Jason Miller, is sequestration could spur furloughs at education. You can read it linked up now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we continue, the second most important story of the week is selected by both Jason and John. Not the same story this time, but you'll hear them next on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
August 15th. My joints ache. Today I can hardly move. I need some answers.
I need some answers. September 3rd. I'm tired all the time.
What's going on? June 8th. I woke up with a rash on my face. I want to know why.
For answers, ask your doctor the right question. Could I have lupus? For answers, for support, for hope, visit couldihavelupus.gov or call 1-800-994-9662. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Office on Women's Health and the Ad Council.
Accenture, high performance delivered. It's how we help clients take on their most complex challenges. We help manage the world's largest biometric systems to protect U.S. citizens. And we help more than 20,000 U.S. communities better respond to natural disasters. As a partner with both public and private industry knowledge, Accenture brings unique insights to help federal organizations in their efforts to protect citizens at home and abroad. Accenture, high performance delivered. To learn more, visit accenture.com/federal.
At Kaiser Permanente, we're about keeping you connected. So we made My Health Manager. It connects you to your doctor, your prescriptions, your test results, and your health records right at home. But what if you aren't home? What if you're visiting family? Or at the beach or on a business trip? What if you're on a steep mountain trail, you know, with loose gravel and one way in and one way out? Now, there's the Kaiser Permanente mobile app. It connects you right from your smartphone. You can email your doctor while visiting family, refill your prescription from the beach, take your medical records on a business trip, or schedule, say, a little checkup from that steep trail. No matter where you are, we'll keep you connected without keeping you from any of life's adventures. Get the app by searching Kaiser Permanente in the Android Market or Apple App Store, or bookmark kp.org on your smartphone. Kaiser Permanente. Thrive.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852. Apple is a registered trademark of Apple Inc. Android is a trademark of Google Inc.
It probably set back the program for a couple of years. But this demonstrated that cyber weapons could physically destroy critical infrastructure. Now, the problem is we have SCADA devices attaching all of the infrastructure we have in the U.S. Our dams, our electrical power grid, everything is remotely controlled by the Internet. And there's always a SCADA device in between the Internet connection and what the device is doing.
Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
I'm Beyonce with an important message about hunger in America. Did you know 1 in 8 people struggle with hunger? Over 12 million children live in homes where there isn't always enough food. Food banks are experiencing more demand than ever. Show Your Helping Hand is a nationwide campaign with the goal of helping Feeding America deliver millions of meals to local food banks. Please join me in showing a helping hand to fight hunger. More information is available at showyourhelpinghand.com.
Tom Temin here with a preview of Monday's Federal Drive. Intellectual property, it's a national asset. The White House fashions a new strategy for protecting that asset, and we'll have an update. And declassifying federal documents, it's a lot more than prying open a box and scanning what's inside. We'll hear from the archives about its latest report on tough to declassify stuff. Those stories and more Monday morning, starting at 6 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, be sure to visit federalnewsradio.com.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by John Palguda of the Partnership for Public Service and Jason Miller, my colleague at Federal News Radio. And we are up to
number two.
John Palguda's second most important federal news story of the week is our Jack Moore's story on federalnewsradio.com, headlined, Lack of Encouragement Causes Agency Innovation to Fizzle. It is totally coincidental, I'm sure, that this story was generated as a result of research done by the Partnership for Public Service. You're familiar with that organization,
I
right,
am,
John?
I am. And imagine my surprise when I saw that that story was based on our work. But yeah, it is my number two story, we started off this segment talking about sequestration and budget and stuff. And when you think about it, you know, regardless of what happens, we're in a budget-constrained environment, but government still has to operate. So you are hoping that your employees are being creative, innovative, looking for new ways of doing business. If you can't do more with less, figure out how you can do it differently with less and still get good results. So we went back into that government-wide survey data, the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey data that we use for our Best Places to Work in Government ranking. And we took a look at questions from that survey that deal with innovation. Employees were asked, you know, I'm constantly looking for ways to do my job better. And well over 90%, 91.5% said, yeah, you know, I mean, that's kind of what I do. It's human nature. But then the counterpart question was, do you feel encouraged by your organization to come up with new ways of doing business better? Only about 3 out of 5, 59% said yes. When you look at the private sector, because there's a comparable question out there in a lot of private sector surveys, 71% of private sector employees say, yeah, we're actually encouraged to look for better ways of doing business. So I think, you know, for us, this kind of highlighted the fact that, you know, we may be missing a bet here. In government, in terms of how do we cope with these budget constraints and the pressures, and we hope part of the message from this is that there's more agencies can do, there's more that agency managers and executives can do to encourage and actually reward people who come forward with better ways of getting the job done.
The innovation nut, though, Jason, has been hard for agencies to crack because innovation is very subjective, and the government structure is not necessarily conducive to subjective decision making and subjective encouragement of your idea over John's and so on and so forth.
Absolutely. And I think innovation also costs money. Mm-hmm. And nobody ever wants to spend money on innovation. I mean, listen, the Bush administration, let's just talk about technology because that's where a lot of the innovation is thought of. How can we do this business process better? Well, let's apply technology to it. The Bush administration tried to move technology spending from steady state to what they call DME, Development Modernization Enhancement. Well, this administration, the Obama administration, is trying to do the same thing. In fact, you've heard Stephen Van Roekel, the federal CIO, come out and say, well, I want you to innovate with less. Okay.
Wait, what?
Right. Not just do more with less, but innovate with less. And what he's saying is stop spending all this money on steady state technology and move it to the business systems where you can be innovative and use that extra money. And in fact, Francis, you and I talked yesterday about the Transportation Department, who is saying we have all these systems, all these services that we're offering. We're going to put them in inventory. We're going to let you rate them, let you find them. And the ones that rated poorly, we're going to talk about getting rid of them and taking that money and putting it somewhere else. So I think what agencies are finding themselves in is because budgets are potentially decreasing, because of potential sequestration, because that technology is offering you the ability through things like cloud computing and data center consolidation initiatives to save money, they see maybe a little bit of light at the end of that innovation tunnel. So I'm not actually surprised that more agencies that say we want to be able to innovate, more employees say we think we can be innovative in our job. I think it's the tools they need, and there's some talk about pushing the tools to them.
Now, John, my colleague Jack Moore writes in this story on federalnewsradio.com, the problem is that too often agency leadership fails to encourage employees to think outside the box or to reward them when they do so. Now, you mentioned you're an old hand at HR before we went on the air talking about this segment. I wonder from that perspective, which is worse? If I were going to guess, I would guess that the rewarding part is probably a good part of the encouragement process for the average employee. So that would probably be the easiest to address. And I recognize in tight budget times, you can't say it would be a little something extra in the envelope for you, but there's got to be something that managers can do.
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right, Francis. And the fact of the matter is, on the rewarding part, there's a whole lot of options beyond monetary rewards. I think for a lot of managers, it's kind of this notion, well, I don't have an awards budget. Sorry, I can't do anything. We're doing a focus group, just as a quick anecdote here, a while back with a group of employees and managers. And, we were asking about ways to better engage employees, and they were having a dialogue among themselves. One of the employees, brave soul, spoke up and said, one of the things that would really help is if we were to get more recognition from management. The answer was, well, I don't have that budget for, to give awards, And the reply from this brave employee was, didn't say anything about money. A simple thank you, a pat on the back, remembering my name.
Printing out a certificate doesn't cost a whole lot of money.
Yeah. So, and same thing, and when you're looking at employees who are coming up with innovative ideas, new ways of getting the job done, just saying, giving them recognition at a staff meeting, like, hey, Jason had this wonderful idea, and actually I think it's going to make a difference, and we're implementing it, and way to go, Jason.
That's a really interesting observation, John, because whenever I hear a manager talk about that issue, at any level, mid-level all the way up to the top, the very first place that they go when it comes to recognition is money. And so to hear an employee, a rank and file employee say, no, I didn't, that's not what I was talking about. To hear that person, that's where they went first. I wonder where that disparity came from and why there's that perception up the chain that all they care, the only thing that will make a difference to them is money. Because you and I have had the conversation 1,000 times that people don't work for the government because they're going to get rich.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And yeah, I'm guessing, Francis, that part of the issue is a lot of managers think they're already doing the encouragement and the thank yous and the recognition, non-monetary. And the fact of the matter is they think it, but their employees aren't seeing it. So they tend to not think about that. But this little snapshot that we did might be a good reminder that, look, just encouraging your folks to do this, recognize, and even if it's something they try and that's not successful, that good try, that pat on the back goes a long way.
All right, I'm going to say it because I know you guys have been dying to say this. It goes back to the culture of the agency. If you look at who's number one, NASA, they have a culture of innovation. They are not only rewarded, but when they take a risk and fail, it's okay. What you hear time and again, specifically in the acquisition community, but you can probably apply to anything, is who has your back if you take a risk? If you take a risk and it fails, who's going to go up to Capitol Hill and say to Congressman X when they're getting the pointed finger at, hey, we tried something that didn't work, but we tried something we think was a good idea. We're going to try something again.
The only place that I might disagree with you on that, though, is NASA is number one on the list. You're right. Number two, though, is maybe the most risk-averse agency that I'm aware of, Nuclear Regulatory Commission.
But is there risk culture – like it all depends on what their culture is around risk. How do they define risk? I mean, obviously, we're all going to define risk or define innovation a little differently. Mm-hmm. I think, NRC – they've done a lot with telework, for instance. They've been one of the best places to work over the last 4 or 5 years. So they're doing something right.
So innovation doesn't have to necessarily be tied specifically to mission delivery. It can be there's a lot of breadth for agencies to consider potentially.
Well,
when it comes
to
innovation.
Even in a place like NRC, it could be mission delivery. It's not, well, let's try not regulating and see how that goes. It could be, there may be a more effective way for us to go and inspect a facility and determine if there are issues than going through our standard checklist. Maybe there's a more effective way. So it's innovation that helps them become even a more effective regulatory agency.
And maybe the thing that I can derive from the 59% number is the perception is maybe as important as reality. The idea that employees think that their ideas will be encouraged and tried and so on is as important as what actually winds up happening and the risks that an agency actually winds up taking.
That is correct. And Jason's point about NASA is well taken. NASA actively encourages the employees, and they have programs and ways to bring that out.
All right. We could go on this one for a long time because I love talking about innovation, but we've got to wrap it. John Palguta's second most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. The headline is "Lack of Encouragement Causes Agency Innovation to Fizzle." It's my colleague Jack Moore's story there. Coming up on In Depth with Francis Rose, the Federal News Countdown continues with Jason Miller's second most important federal news story of the week on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
This is a transformative time for the Department of Defense. The military is progressing toward a smaller, nimbler force capable of rapidly responding to any threat around the globe. Secure, next-generation communications capabilities are essential, ensuring personnel can get the information they need from virtually any location, anytime, on any compatible device. Microsoft offers today's military leaders the next wave of technologies, providing advanced security features without compromising productivity and mission effectiveness, all at a price that makes sense. From the front lines to the command center to the Pentagon, Microsoft and its global partner network are working with defense leaders to create solutions that not only meet but anticipate today's service member needs. Whether it's providing secure online collaboration and editing capabilities or voice and video through unified communications, Microsoft is equipping warriors in motion with the familiar technology they use every day to get the job done. That's real impact for tomorrow's military. Learn more about defense IT solutions at Microsoft.com/DOD.
Rock that fanny pack, wearing those khakis last.
Kevin,
yeah?
What are you doing?
Just singing this sweet tune I heard on the radio this morning.
We need to get you HD radio, man. Those are not the lyrics. If you were listening to that song in my Kia Optima with the Yuvo infotainment system and HD radio, you'd hear all the lyrics with crystal clear digital sound quality. Plus the artist and song title even display on my Yuvo screen.
Then let's go for a ride and hope the fanny pack song comes on.
Voice-activated Yuvo infotainment system with HD radio, now available in the Kia Optima.
It's not 911 over there. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss with HHS HealthBeat. Everything should go just fine for folks at the Summer Olympics in London. But if you're visiting and need medical help, keep in mind some things about how the British system works. At the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Dr. Phyllis Kazarski notes that Brits don't call 911 for help. It's 999 over there. Similarly, the driving on the other side of the road business can make our U.S. street crossing habits dangerous.
In the United States, we learn to look left, look right, and look left again before crossing. In England, travelers should look right, look left, and look right again.
U.S. health insurance might not cover you in Britain. If it doesn't, you have to pay out of pocket, so you might check your policy and maybe buy travel insurance. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, every Friday in the 3 o'clock hour. We count down the three most important federal news stories of the week with two people who are experts in the world of the federal government. They make the choices, and you get to hear their analysis of those stories. Today, my experts are John Palguda of the Partnership for Public Service and my colleague Jason Miller from Federal News Radio. And Jason, your second most important federal news story of the week is headlined GAO and FPS disagree over ability to assess federal building risk. This is Ruben Gomez's story on federalnewsradio.com. What is the core of this? Because when I read the GAO report, I got a different takeaway than I did when I actually read Ruben's story.
I think the core of this is why some people sometimes maybe get a little frustrated with GAO. I think, again, I'll preface this with the old GAO does a very good job. They have a hard job to do. But here GAO is asking, it was kind of hitting FPS on the knuckles by saying, your software, this thing called MIST, the Modified Infrastructure Survey Tool, doesn't assess building vulnerabilities. And the David Patterson, the director of the Federal Protective Service, says, okay, well, we know that. We have processes in place to help do that, and the software's not meant to do that yet because that software capability does not exist in the market. Nobody has made it. Nobody is making it. But all GAO can hear is, right, but it doesn't exist in your software. And FPS says, I know it doesn't exist. What do you want from me? And I think that the kind of disconnect is missing the broader point. Is, are federal buildings safer? Does this MIST, again, Modified Infrastructure Survey Tool, make things better? Because the RAMP program, the Risk Assessment Management Program that FPS was working on, was a failure. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the frustration again around GAO. Sometimes they're not focusing on the today. They're focusing on the what if, what should be. And I think I was told by some very smart person in our office, you shouldn't go with what should. It's what is.
when you look at this, John, it sounds like what Jason's saying they should be focusing on is the result rather than the vehicle. Do you think I'm reading that right?
I think, well, I'm hearing two things. Certainly the result, but also, you know, kind of the state of the art, too. I mean, you know, it's great to say, well, you should have something that would do all these wonderful things, but if that does not yet exist, it's not a slap on the wrist for not having it. It really should be a focus. Well, how do we get it? Mm-hmm. What would it take to develop that better tool? But in the meantime, you got to use what you got.
Right. I'd be okay, I guess, from a story perspective, the GAO said to Congress, listen, the Federal Protective Service is not working with the Science and Technology Director at a DHS to get someone to build this. They're not working with some of the R&D folks to get this piece built, or they haven't gone out with an RFP to ask for this. But all they're saying is it doesn't exist. I mean, at the very end of Ruben's story, it says, Goldstein says GAO hasn't looked into Patterson's claim of specifically, but that GAO did recently begin looking at assessment tools across the federal government. So the report doesn't even look at it, for instance.
Well, and Ruben's story also says, Patterson said the eventual solution is to develop a tool that incorporates consequence analysis into its risk assessment. So that's part of the goal. And then he goes on to say this capability doesn't currently exist and there's no place for us to buy it.
Right.
So it seems like it's kind of – this is the textbook example of two parties talking past each other, it
yes.
sounds to me.
And I guess imagine that FPS is feeling they're in a catch-22 situation. They're being criticized for not doing something that they're currently incapable of doing, mm-hmm. Not through any fault of their own.
Well, they're incapable of doing it through software. They say that we are doing this through our internal processes. And, I think that – when we looked at this hearing as something to cover and decided that, Ruben decided to go cover it, one of the things that stood out to me was the FPS got beaten up quite a bit by Congress in 2010 over their ability to use security guards and what type of security guards they're hiring, whether it's contractor or in-house. And I thought that's where we were going to go with this. I thought the hearing would revisit, has the Federal Protective Service improved the training, the oversight, the hiring, how if they brought guards back in-house. And for, Ruben to walk away to say the biggest story was about the software tool, it shows it was a little disappointing that maybe Congress didn't write ask the right questions.
One of the things that the subcommittee chairman, Dan Lundgren from California, did say, FPS has always stated that MIST is intended to serve as an interim tool until a longer-term solution is developed, which seems to fit with what the agency is saying at this particular hearing. Here's the only place, Jason, that I think they might be able to score a point, if that's what this is all about, on FPS. FPS has never stated, this is Congressman Lundgren saying this, what the longer-term solution will be. And maybe conveying that vision to the committee would help them understand, okay, we'll set aside what GAO is saying here and take your word for it and give you an opportunity to try to move forward.
I think the same thing with GAO. If they save that longer-term vision to GAO, GAO might come back with a different conclusion as well.
The second most important federal news story of the week, on according to my colleague Jason Miller, is headline, GAO and FPS disagree over ability to assess federal building risk. It's posted now at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. It is my colleague Ruben Gomez's story on federalnewsradio.com. You can see all of the stories that we're counting down at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, and you'll hear number one as selected by John Palguda and Jason Miller when the Federal News Countdown continues in just a moment.
This is NIH Health Matters. I'm Joe Belinfi. The NIH and the EPA are challenging the public to build a sensor that will help researchers, physicians, and communities better understand how the environment and health are connected. Dr. David Balshaw at the NIH explains the goal.
Can we develop a single package that's very wearable, very unobtrusive, takes advantage of the kind of modern technologies, the smartphones that we have, to link what people are exposed to and how it affects their breathing or their heart rate, skin temperature, conductance, as they have a physiological response to their environment?
Learn more about the My Air, My Health competition at www.challenge.gov. Health Matters is produced by the National Institutes of Health, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Time is running out. Congress has until September 30th to pass agency spending bills for 2013. What's the latest on your agency's funding? How much will your budget be cut? And how will sequestration play a role? FederalNewsRadio.com's budget tracker has the latest on the 12 annual appropriations bills. Follow your agency's funding as it makes its way through the House and Senate and to President Obama's desk. Find the budget tracker online at federalnewsradio.com. Search budget tracker.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, the Federal News Countdown. Every week includes the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by two people who are experts in the world of the federal government. John Palguda of the Partnership for Public Service and Federal News Radio Executive Editor Jason Miller are my experts, and we're up to
number one.
The most important federal news story of the week from John Palguda is a Washington Post story headlined, Federal versus Private Sector Pay. No comparison is definitive, auditors say. And we're back to the GAO again. I will say that Robert Goldenkopf, the writer of this report, the author of this GAO report, was a guest on the show yesterday. And you can hear that conversation. Find a link to the report on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The message that I took away from my conversation with Robert and from this story and the overall conversation about this GAO report, John, is there are three different ways that people historically have looked at federal pay and comparing it to the private sector. They're all three reasonable, but none of the three will produce the same results, and that's okay. That's reasonable. Am I reading it right, do you think?
Yes.
yes, but.
yes, but.
I hear the but in your voice.
Well, you would imagine that there'd be some differences, but these are huge differences. And I think you're right. The message is that it's not that, well, there's one point of view is correct and the others are obviously wrong. I think the value of this is a couple things. One, we're at a point in the evolution of government and in our budget environment where I think federal pay is already receiving a lot of scrutiny. We've got the pay freeze and we've got calls in Congress for, finding ways to reduce federal salaries and others saying, but, we're already way underpaid. So I think it's past time to look at the federal pay system. The main system, we have multiple systems in government right now. We don't have one system, but the main one called the General Schedule was put in law in 1949. The world has changed a lot since then. So if we were to start from scratch and design a new system, what would it look like? It would not look like what we have, but the problem is what should it look like if the goal is to find a system that would help government attract, motivate, and retain quality employees? And the GAO is pointing out is that, man, this is a tough thing because you got to figure out if the question is the goal is, well, let's at least pay employees somewhere in the ballpark of what private sector counterparts get paid. You would think that'll be easy, but this GAO report says, wow, you're going to have very different results depending on the methodology you use.
So what I'm hearing you say, as I try to read between the lines as you're speaking, is that the GAO report unintentionally may be focusing us, distracting us a little bit from what the actual discussion is, which is how do we make this system work better? Whether that means tearing it apart and starting over or fixing what we have, how do we make it work better? And these reports always continue to focus us on private versus public.
Yes, and it's that, but and ultimately you got to compare. I mean, the government doesn't work in isolation. It should be part of the larger labor pool. But I know Robert Goldenkopf and the group out at GAO that they're fine analysts. They did a very good job. But you long for the follow on of, okay, what would be the best way of all of these different options?
And that's where I think GAO missed the boat a little bit. I mean, again, I know they have a hard job. I'm not taking it away
from
them.
Well, this is two in a row.
Two in a row.
GAO.
I better not call them for an interview soon.
Yeah, really.
They may not like me so much.
Shut you down.
But I think that they should have come out and said, here's the most appropriate way to gauge this. Whatever the most appropriate way is, I don't have the answer to that. And I think by them just kind of not having a conclusion, not having a recommendation, is kind of kicking the can down the road. And this issue is not going to go away. John, I don't disagree with you in the fact that the GS system is 60 years old or whatever it is and it needs to be changed. But changing it, there's no political will to change it because of what it would actually mean. And real quick, and the idea that the benefits are cost so much and bring everything equal. I mean, you look at people in government who leave government and how much do they make when they leave government, and it's never a pay cut.
Maybe, though, this is not a GAO problem, and maybe it's a Congress problem, because GAO generates reports for two reasons. They either have to legislatively, that's Congress telling them through legislation they have to do it, or a member specifically requests them to look at something, and maybe nobody requested that they report back on what would be the best way to conduct this research and make those comparisons.
And I think you are right there, Francis. I mean, they answer the question that they are asked. And so this study answered the question that they were asked, but maybe it's a member of Congress that should ask the next question.
And maybe we'll see that. Maybe there's somebody on that.
And I would agree. But at the same time, is it out of GAO bounds? I guess this is more of a question for the audience here. Is it out of GAO bounds to put forth a recommendation to Congress?
I think it might be. I think it's their job to answer questions and not to propose answers to questions that were not asked.
Well, they do have a small discretionary amount of discretionary funds. I mean, they probably spend, and I don't quote me on this, but 95% of their funding goes to, answering what's asked. They have a little bit of discretion to explore things that they think are useful to explore.
I was going to say, but in this case, if this is a request from a congressman or a senator, and the congressman said, look at the methodologies that are out there and describe them for us. And that was the question. Could they go to the next step further and say, we believe this methodology is the best one? Could they do that without being asked that question?
I'm not going to speak for them, but I would think if I were in that position, I would hesitate to tell a member of Congress that they didn't ask me the right question. that's all I will say. The most important federal news story of the week, as selected by John Palguda, is from the Washington Post. The headline is Federal versus Private Sector Pay. No comparison is definitive, auditors say. You can read that story. You can read the GAO report that generated that story at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, my colleague Jason Miller's selection for the most important federal news story of the week on the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose.
Are you a skilled IT professional looking to be called by your first name instead of your employee number? If so, Preferred Systems Solutions is calling your name. Since 1991, PSS has offered customers and employees the attention of a small business while delivering capabilities of a large enterprise. With contracts across the DoD, civilian, and intelligence communities, PSS offers opportunities in ERP, intelligence, IT, and program management. PSS offers a dynamic workplace, competitive compensation, and best-in-class benefits. To join their team, visit PSSFed.com and click Career.
The year was 1912. There were 141 miles of paved roads in the U.S. The Eiffel Tower was the world's tallest building. The airplane was 9 years old. And three aviation pioneers were hard at work in California. Two of them, Alan and Malcolm Lockheed, were spending their nights building a seaplane in a garage where they spent their days repairing cars. The third, Glenn L. Martin, whose first airplane factory was a rented church, was taking a leap of faith on a new design. In May of that year, Martin piloted his Model 12 in a 30-minute flight over Newport Bay. And the Lockheed brothers soared to an altitude of 300 feet over San Francisco Bay in their Model G. 100 years later, the company that bears their names still shares their pioneering spirit. See their story and others unfold at LockheedMartin.com/100 years.
GovEvents.com is your one-stop shop for government and military events worldwide. With hundreds of event organizers posting their government and military-related conferences, trade shows, expos, webcasts, and more, you'll save time and energy using GovEvents to find events to attend, exhibit, or sponsor. Search for government and military events by date, location, keyword, organizer, or focus. It's free, so join today. GovEvents.com. That's GovEvents.com.
This is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. The Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by two experts in the world of the federal government. This week, it's John Palguda from the Partnership for Public Service and my colleague, Jason Miller. And Jason, your choice is Jared Serbu's FederalNewsRadio.com story, DOD Extends Civilian Hiring Restrictions Through 2018. Now, this has been characterized other places as a hiring freeze. Technically, it's not that. It's not that they can't hire anybody. This is more, this is a restriction on the size of the workforce overall. Attrition and new hires will still happen over the course of this. But this is 6 years. This is right. A long time.
I think that's what stood out to me was the two things. Number one, this is a great story by our colleague Jared Serbu. This is, once again, why he's such a super reporter. But beyond the accolations we can give him all day, I think that this just shows you the depth and the problems that DOD expects to be facing when it comes to budget. And this type of problem is saying, we don't think we can hire people. We don't think we can increase our ranks, so we got to make sure we get it done with who we have. So I think there's two pieces here. The fact that this has hiring restrictions or in some ways a freeze of at current levels. And two, that means the DOD training and the DOD what they're going to focus on from an employee standpoint, meaning where they're going to put their resources, becomes much more interesting and a lot different than it had has in the past. And with people coming with the soldiers and airmen and Marines and sailors coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, well, mostly Afghanistan now, what's that mean for people who, you know, do they stay in the military? Do they get out? And what does that mean for VA? I mean, there's a whole snowball effect that could happen from this.
Congress cracks me up because they're predictable. Members have their little things that they're issues that they care about, and the responses are very predictable. And I mean no disrespect in this case to Congressman Randy Forbes, who by all accounts is an upstanding citizen and a member of the House Armed Services Committee. Jared reports, Congressman Randy Forbes suggested the policies might also contradict previously enacted laws prohibiting the department from setting a maximum number of civilian employees. Does the cap presume that the budget's driving the DOD's civilian workforce requirements or vice versa? And the witness, Frederick Volrath of DOD, saying, no, it's not a cap, and explaining why it's not a cap. Spokesperson for the Pentagon confirmed to Jared later, this is not a cap. This is and here's why. And the story on FederalNewsRadio.com includes their justification for this. But Congressman Forbes has been outspoken against the idea of cutting defense and cutting the amount of employees there, represents a huge number of defense employees in his district in the Norfolk area. I don't believe his district encompasses Norfolk proper or any of the military bases, but it's right up close in southeastern Virginia. These roles that we're seeing members of Congress go through, John, are very predictable, and it's almost as if we could write them before the hearings take place.
Almost. But and there's something else, too, in this story that should not be overlooked. It says that the there's references an earlier memo obtained by Federal News Radio that said the department was going to try to hold service contractor personnel, not just federal employees, but service contractor personnel at levels 30% below what they paid for in 2010. So it's a double whammy, if you will. We're going to, if it's not a freeze, it's a frost, I guess. We're going to hold the numbers of civilian employees, defense employees down, but we're also going to try to hold the number of contract employees down. And I'll tell you, that can really start hurting at some point. People might remember during the reinvention of government, the National Performance Review in the 90s, we reduced the size of the workforce by 350,000 employees, but the size of the contractor workforce grew substantially, in part to make up. So it's a total force idea. And if you're unable to grow any part of your workforce and you're looking for some reductions, it's going to be tough.
Now, this also ties into something that we talked about earlier about the workforce, Jason, and that is the idea of looking at exactly what it is the agency is expected to do, what's the core mission, who do we need to do it, and then if there are folks that we have that we don't need, then maybe it's time to hold the line on them.
And I think that's something that DOD is looking to do. I mean, if you Jared goes into the story a little bit of two things. One, they're looking at where the service contractors are working in within which services, and they're saying, okay, they already have supposed to have done an inventory, so where can we then put our resources based on the services that we need? But I think they're also, as they say later on in the story as well, that they're going to look at their mission and how to balance their civilian workforce needs against their mission. So I think DOD is trying to go about this smartly. Now, what's the end result? We don't know. I mean, I remember during the 90s, the mistakes that DOD made with cutting the acquisition workforce, and they still haven't recovered. So, and they swear we're not going to make those same mistakes again. Let's see.
The most important federal news story of the week, as selected by my colleague Jason Miller, is from federalnewsradio.com. The headline is DOD extends civilian hiring restrictions through 2018. It's Jared Serbu's story on federalnewsradio.com. All of the stories that we talked about on the countdown today are posted at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, and you can read them there. John Palguda, great to see you as always. Love having you on the show.
It's always a pleasure, Francis.
And same with you, Jason Miller from Federal News Radio and federalnewsradio.com. You'll be on with me again on Monday.
As always.
And Jason's coverage, tons of stuff that he's working on federalnewsradio.com. Hour number two of In-Depth with Francis Rose coming in a moment on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.